stones to join the old. By the time the torrent struck, all of the doomed men in that riverbed understood. The sound was no longer a distant thunder. It was a howling banshee, Shiva's shriek, Kali's scream of triumph. All of them now were fighting to get out. Their horses, panicked as much by the terror in their riders' voices as the thunder coming from the north, were scuttling through the mud, skittering past the reeds, falling into sinkholes, trampling each other under. But it was hopeless. Some of the Malwa soldiers, less than 1,000, were far enough from the riverbed center to reach the banks. Others, caught by the edges of the tidal wave, were able to save their lives by clinging to reeds or boulders or ropes thrown by their comrades ashore. A few, a very, very small few, even survived the flood. A gigantic, turbulent mass of water such as the one which hammered its way down the riverbed is an odd thing, fickle at times, weird in its workings. The Euphrates, restored to its rightful place, raged and raged and raged. But here and there it took pity. One soldier, to his everlasting amazement, found himself carried gently, gently to the riverbank. Another, too terrified to be amazed, was simply tossed ashore. And one Malwa soldier, hours later and 50 miles downriver, waded out of the reeds. The Euphrates had nestled him in a bizarre and permanent little eddy, like a chick cupped in a man's hand, and carried him through the night. A simple man he was, simple-minded his unkind former comrades had often called him, but no fool. It was noted thereafter that the previously profane fellow had become deeply religious, particularly devoted, it seemed, to river gods. But for the overwhelming majority of the Yetai and Malwa regulars caught in Belisarius's trap, death came almost instantly. They didn't even drown, most of them. They were simply battered to death. 12,143 men, dead within a minute. Another 906 crippled and badly wounded. Most of those would die within a week. 10,089 horses dead. 2,278 camels dead. 34 rocket carts pulverized. Almost half of the expedition's gunpowder weapons destroyed. It was the worst military disaster in Malwa's history. And Link knew it. The super-being was already examining its options before the wall of water had taken a single life. Throughout the horror which followed, the creature named Great Lady Holly sat motionless upon its throne. Utterly indifferent to the carnage, those dying men and animals were simply facts, it went about its business. Calculating, gauging, assessing. The officers would take the blame. Link would take the credit for salvaging what could be salvaged. Calculating. Gauging, assessing, which was not much. By the time the next rank of officers crept their timid way onto the command tower, Link had already made its decisions. We must retreat. Beat the drums. Organize rationing. We will be forced to retreat through the desert with few camels. We cannot risk a battle on this side of the river. Belisarius will have also collapsed the stones into the Nahar Malka, restoring the old dam. He will be able to cross easily, and there are still 10,000 Persians in Barozhapur. Our forces there must keep those Persians penned in while we make our retreat. Even with the grim reminder of the slaughtered officers lying on the platform, some of Link's new top subordinates dared to protest. Through the desert? Many will die in such a retreat.
At least 4,000, by my estimate. They can be replaced.
And what about the Kushans? There are 8,000 of them in position to attack.
Pointless. They have no horses, no supplies, and we have no means of supplying them. Our own supplies are limited. Belisarius will not fight. He will simply elude the Kushans and wait for them to die of hunger. A waste of excellent troops whom we need ourselves. We must begin the retreat immediately. Send couriers to the Kushans. They must guard our rear as we march back to Babylon.
The officers bowed their heads. They began to scurry out, but Link commanded them to remain. There were still some calculations to be made. The officers waited silently while Link gauged and assessed. It didn't take the super-being more than 5 minutes to reach another conclusion. A human commander faced with that bitter logic would have screamed fury and frustration. Link simply gave commands.
Send word to our forces in Babylon. Tell the commanders to await our arrival, but they must begin the preparations for lifting the siege of Babylon.
A last protest.
Lift the siege of Babylon, but... We have no choice. Belisarius has savaged us this year due to the incompetence of Malwa's generals. Our supply fleet was already stretched to the limit. This new disaster will destroy more ships. We have lost too many men, too many supplies, too much equipment. We cannot maintain the siege. We must retreat to Carax and begin again next year. Do it.
When the wall of water reached Perosh Shapur in the middle of the night, more Malwa lives were lost. Not many, simply those unlucky men among the forces guarding against the Sally who had chosen the wrong moment to relieve themselves in the riverbed, away from the foul latrines of a siege camp. Above, on the walls of the fortified town, Beresminus and Kurush listened to the river. The Euphrates was back, and with it, hope.
He has done it, whispered Kurush, just as he promised.
He turned away, moving with his quick and nervous stride.
I must ready the troops. We may be able to sally come dawn.
After he was gone, Beresminus shook his head.
How can such a warm and merciful man be so ruthless, he whispered. So cold, so cruel, so pitiless.
There was no accusation in those words, neither condemnation nor reproach. Simply wonder at the complexity and contradiction that is the human soul. Elsewhere within the walls of Perosh Shapur, in the slave quarters where war captives were held, 2,000 Kushans also listened to the sound of Malwa's destruction. Friendly guards were questioned. Soon enough, answers were given. The Kushans settled their bets. Those who had won the wager, all but one, celebrated through the night. They had the means with which to celebrate, too. Their guards were in a fine mood that night. Wine was given out freely, even by stingy Persians. Only Vasudeva refrained from the festivity. When questioned, the Kushan commander simply smiled and said,
You forget. I made another bet. Enjoy yourselves, men.
Grinning now and pointing at the amphorae clutched in his soldiers' hands.
Soon everything you own will be mine.
By the end of the next day, the Malwa guarding Perosh Shapur began their retreat. Kurush, against Beresminus's advice, tried a sally. His Dagans bloodied the enemy, but they were driven off with heavy casualties. The Malwa lion was wounded and limping badly, but it still had its teeth. The day after that, the Kushans were sent out to clear the riverbanks of the multitude of corpses which had washed ashore. Bury them quickly, no sanctified exposure to the elements for those foul souls, so that the stench wouldn't sicken the entire city. The Kushans did their work uncomplainingly. They had another bet to settle. By the end of the day, the count had been made to every Kushan's satisfaction, and Vasudeva won his bet. Many bodies had been buried and their identities noted. There was not a single Kushan among them. Vasudeva was rich now, for he had been the only Kushan to dare that gamble. Rich not so much in material wealth, his soldiers had had little to wager after all, but in the awe and esteem of his men. Kushans admire a great gambler.
How did you know? Asked one of his lieutenants.
Vasudeva smiled.
He promised me. When we gave our oath to him, he swore in return that he would treat Kushans as men, executed as necessary, but executed as men, not hanged like criminals or beaten like dogs.
He pointed to the river below Perosh Shapur.
Or drowned like rats.
The lieutenant frowned.
He made that vow to us, not...
A gesture with his head upriver.
To those Kushans.
Vasudeva's smile was quite like that of a Buddha now.
Belisarius is not one to make petty distinctions.
The commander of the Kushan captives turned away.
Your mistake was that you bet on the general. I bet on the man.
2 days later at Babylon, Khosrow Anushirvan also basked in the admiration of his subordinates. Many of them, many, had questioned his wisdom in placing so much trust in a Roman general. Some of them had even been bold enough and honest enough to express those reservations to the Emperor's face. None questioned his wisdom now. They had but to stand on the walls of Babylon to see how wise their emperor had been. The Malwa fleet had been savaged when Belisarius lowered the river. It had been savaged again when he restored it. A full quarter of the enemy's remaining ships had been destroyed in the first few minutes. Tethered to jury-rigged docks, or simply grounded in the mud, they had been lifted up by the surging Euphrates and carried to their destruction. Some were battered to splinters, others grounded anew, still others capsized. And Khusrow had sallied again. Not this time with Dagon's across a pontoon bridge. No one could have built a bridge across the roaring Euphrates on that day, but with sailors aboard a handful of swift galleys in his possession. The galleys had been kept ashore until the river's initial fury passed. As soon as the waters subsided to mere turbulence, the galleys set forth. Down the Euphrates they rowed, adding their own speed to the current and destroying every Malwa ship they encountered, which had managed to survive the Euphrates' rebirth. There was almost no resistance. The galleys passed too swiftly for the enemy's cannons to be brought to bear, and the Malwa soldiers on the ships themselves were too dazed to put up any effective resistance. Down the Euphrates the galleys went, mile after mile, until the rowers were too weak to pull their oars. They left a trail of burning ships 30 miles behind them before they finally beached their craft and began the long march back to Babylon, on the west bank of the river, where the Malwa could no longer reach them. Between the river and the Persian galleys, over half of the remaining Malwa fleet was destroyed. Not more than 2 dozen ships eventually found their way back to Carax, of the mighty armada which had set forth so proudly at the beginning of the year. Other than sending forth the galleys, Khusrow made no attempt to sally against the Malwa encamped before Babylon. He was too canny to repeat Kurush's mistake at Peroz Shapur. The Malwa lion had been lamed, true. It had not been declawed. There were still 100,000 men in that enemy army, with their siege guns loaded with canister. The emperor simply waited. Let them starve. The siege of Babylon had been broken like a tree gutted by a lightning bolt. It had simply not fallen yet, much like a great tree will stand for a time after it is dead, until a wind blows the hollow thing over. That wind arrived 12 days later. Emperor Khusrow and his entourage from the roof of Ezagila watched the survivors of the Malwa expedition drag their mangled army back into the camps at Babylon. That army was much smaller than the one which had set out a few weeks since. Smaller in numbers of men and horses and camels, and positively minuscule in its remaining gunpowder weapons. 2 days later, the entire Malwa army began its long retreat south. By nightfall, the camps which had besieged Babylon for months were empty. Khusrow spent all of that day also on top of Ezagila. Surrounded by his officers, his advisors, his officials, a small horde of Sadaran and Vuzurgan, and a young girl named Tahmina. Khusrow's more hot-headed officers called for a sally. Again, the emperor refused. Malwa was lamed, but still a lion. And besides, the Persian monarch had other business to attend to. "Ormazd," he hissed. "Ormazd first. I want his head brought to me on a pike by year's end. Do it." His officers hastened to obey. Surrounded by the rest of his huge entourage, the emperor remained on Ezagila. For a time, he stared at the retreating Malwa, with satisfaction, hatred, and anticipation. "Next year," he murmured. "Next year, Malwa." Then he turned and began striding to the opposite wall of the great ancient temple. His entourage began to follow like a giant millipede, but Khusrow waved them back. "I only want Tahmina," he commanded. Disgruntled but obedient, his officials and nobles and advisors obeyed. Timidly, hesitantly, the girl did likewise. Once they were standing alone on the north wall of the temple, Khusrow's gaze was fixed on the northwest horizon. There was nothing to see there beyond a river and a desert. But the emperor was looking beyond, in time, even more than in space. His emotions now, as he stared northwest, were more complex. Satisfaction also, of course, as well as admiration, respect, even if the truth be told, love. but there was also fear and dread and anxiety. "Next year, Malwa," he murmured again. "But the year after that, and after that, and after that, there will be Rome. Always Rome." He turned his head and lowered his eyes to the girl standing at his side. Under her emperor's gaze, the girl's own eyes shied away.
"Look at me, Tahmina."
When the girl's face rose, Khusro smiled. "I will not command you in this, child, but I do need you. The Aryans need you." Tahmina smiled herself now. Timidly and uncertainly, true, but a smile it was. Quite a genuine one, Khusro saw, and he wasn't a man easily fooled.
"I will, Emperor."
Khusro nodded and placed a hand on the girl's shoulder. Thereafter, and for the rest of the day, he said nothing. Nor did he leave his post on the northern wall of Esagila watching the northwest. The Malwa enemy could limp away behind his contemptuous back. Khusro of the Immortal Soul was the Emperor of Iran and non-Iran. His duty was to face the future. Chapter 39. Days later, Belisarius and Morris surveyed the Nahar Maka from what was left of the rock pile on its north bank. Most of those rocks, so laboriously hauled out by the Kushans, were back where they came from. Once again, the Royal Canal was dry, or almost so, at least. The crude and explosive manner in which Belisarius had rebuilt the dam didn't stop all the flow. The Roman army was already halfway across what was left of the Nahar Malka, on their way back to Peroz Shapur now. After destroying the dam, Belisarius had retreated north in case the Malwa made an attempt to pursue his still outnumbered army. He hadn't expected them to make that mistake, not with Link in command, but had been prepared to deal with the possibility. Once it became clear that the enemy was retreating back to Babylon, Belisarius had followed. They had reached the site of the battleground just 2 hours before.
"Enough," he said softly. "The Nahar Malka's dry enough. I don't think Khusro will complain."
"Shouldn't think so," muttered Morris.
The Kiliarch wasn't even looking at the Nahar Malka, however. He was staring at the Euphrates. Not at the river, actually. The Euphrates, to all appearances, was back to its usual self, a wide, shallow, sluggishly moving mass of muddy water. No, Morris was staring at the banks of the river, where the Malwa had abandoned their dead. It wasn't hard to spot the corpses, hundreds, thousands of them, even hidden in the reeds. The vultures cover the area like flies.
"Jesus," he whispered, "forgive us our sins."
Belisarius turned his eyes to follow Morris's gaze. No expression came to his face. He might have been a simple village blacksmith studying the precision of his work. When he spoke, his voice was harsh. "A man told me once that war is murder. Organized, systematic murder, nothing more and nothing less. It was the first thing that man said to me on the day I assumed command as an officer. 17 years old I was. Green as the springtime."
"You were never as green as the springtime," murmured Morris. "Day you were born, you were already thinking crooked thoughts."
He sighed.
"I remember, lad. It was true then, and it's true now. But I don't have to like it."
Belisarius nodded. Nothing further was said. A few minutes later, he and Morris turned their horses and rode down to the bank of the Nahar Malka, ready to join the army in its crossing. The job wasn't finished. Not yet. Neither of them knew when it might be, but they knew when a day's work was done. Done well. They could take satisfaction in that, at least, if not in the doing. Craftsmen at their trade. Epilogue. A throng and its thoughts. From her position on the dais against the east wall, Antonina surveyed the scene with satisfaction. The great audience chamber of the prefectural palace was literally packed with people. Servants carrying platters of food and drink were forced to wriggle their way through the throng like so many eels. The noise produced by the multitude of conversations was almost deafening.
Very gratifying, pronounced Patriarch Theodosius, seated on a chair next to her.
Isn't it?
Antonina beamed upon the mob below them.
I think the entire Greek aristocracy of Alexandria showed up tonight, as well as most of the nobility from all the major delta towns, even some from the valley, the Fayum at least, and Antonopolis.
A slight frown came.
Actually, I'm a bit puzzled. Hadn't really expected such a massive turnout. I thought for sure that a good half of the nobility would boycott the affair.
Theodosius's eyes widened.
Boycott? A public celebration in honor of the emperor's 9th birthday? God forbid.
The patriarch smiled slyly.
Actually, Antonina, I am not surprised. Left to their own devices, I'm quite sure that half of Egypt's Greek noblemen would never have come. But their wives and daughters gave them no choice.
He nodded toward the middle of the great room where the crowd was thickest. At the very center of that incredible population density, a cup of wine in one hand, stood a handsome young Roman officer.
Egypt's most eligible bachelor, stated the patriarch. The Merarch of the Army of Egypt, newly elected to the Senate and already quite rich on his own account due to his share of the spoils from Minduas.
Antonina stared at Hermogenes. A bit of sadness came to her for a brief moment, thinking about Irene. The host of women who surrounded Hermogenes were all younger than Irene, and with perhaps one or two exceptions, considerably prettier.
But all their brains together, she muttered, and they could maybe match Irene, and she's passed out drunk. Maybe.
What was that, Antonina? Asked Theodosius.
Antonina shook her head.
Never mind, Patriarch. I was just thinking about a dear friend.
Sigh.
Who will never, I fear, find a husband.
Too pious? Asked Theodosius.
Antonina bit off a laugh.
No, just too much.
She rose from her seat.
I will take my leave now. The event is clearly a roaring success. I think we can safely conclude that Alexandria and Egypt have been returned to the imperial fold. But I'm tired, and I don't think that crowd will object to my absence.
Theodosius suppressed his own humor now until after Antonina had walked out. Then he did laugh, seeing the mob below heave a great collective sigh of relief. The patriarch was quite certain he could read their minds at that moment.
Thank God she's gone. No real woman has tits that big. Satan's spawn, that's what she is. The whore from hell. Beelzebub's bitch.
But they kept those thoughts to themselves. Oh yes, discreet they were. Reserved.
Very proper folk, said Theodosius approvingly, turning to the man seated to his right. Very polite, very noble. Don't you think so, Ashot?
A charitable interpretation from a man of God. Less charitable was an Armenian cataphract's response.
Scared shitless. That's what they are.
A king and his fears.
You're not thinking of marrying that woman,
demanded the Negusa Nagast of Aksum. The sovereign of Ethiopia leaned forward on his royal stool, his thick hands planted firmly on powerful knees, his massive jaw clamped shut. He frowned ferociously upon his youngest son. Prince Aeon bolted erect on his own stool. His jaw sagged, dropped, plummeted like a stone. Standing behind him, Usanas burst into laughter.
Excellent idea, King of Kings, cried the Dawaz. Certain to shrink overconfident fool boy's head into a walnut.
Aeon finally caught his breath, enough at least to choke out,
Marry Irene?
He goggled at his father. The father glowered back.
You seem much taken by this woman, accused the Negusa Nagast.
Aeon's eyes roamed about the royal chamber as if seeking rhyme or reason lurking somewhere in the stone recesses of heavy Aksumite architecture.
I like her, yes, he said.
Very much. I think she's incredibly capable and intelligent, and very witty. She often makes me laugh. A wonderful ally in our struggle, even...
His eyes almost crossed, contemplating absurdity.
Yes, even attractive, in her way, but marry her?
He fell silent. Again, his jaw sagged.
Satisfied, the Negusinagast leaned back in his stool. He fixed Usanas with a stern gaze.
Good thing for you, Dawaz. Any other answer, I would have you beaten.
Usanas looked smug.
Can't. Dawaz not subject to royal authority. Only answers to Dekuan Sawe.
The King of Kings snorted.
So, you think the regiment would hesitate? Just last night the demon woman took half their monthly stipend, answering all their riddles. This morning she took the rest, when they couldn't answer any of hers, even after she gave them all night to think it over.
The Negusinagast glared.
There was, be a bloody pulp prince give any other answer, be sure of it.
The Negusinagast smacked his heavy thigh.
I'm satisfied. The prince is foolish as a rooster, true, headstrong like a bull. Who else would get me in a war with Malwa? But at least you have kept him sane, Dawaz. Sane enough. Delusions of grandeur can be tolerated in a king, so long as they are merely political. Never delusions in a wife.
His heavy shoulders twitched, as if a sudden shiver had run down his spine.
God save us from that fate. Never marry a woman smarter than you. Too dangerous, especially for a king. That woman, smarter than Satan.
He turned his head, looking through the entryway to the room beyond. His library, that was.
Best collection of books south of Alexandria, he noted proudly. I have instructed my slaves to make a precise count. They will count them again before I allow that woman to leave for India.
Aeon cleared his throat.
We must leave soon, father.
The Negusinagast nodded his head. The gesture was slow, but certain, as solid as the head which made it.
Yes, you must. Important to follow up on Garmat's successful mission, and quickly. Give all support to Empress Shakuntala and her cause. Give Malwa no time to think.
Again, the little shiver in the shoulders.
Essential to get that woman on the other side of an ocean.
An Empress and Her Marriage.
The time has come, Shakuntala, stated Holker firmly.
The Peshwa leaned forward and lifted a scroll lying on the carpet before his cushion.
This was brought by courier ship this morning from Tamrapani.
Dadaji unrolled the scroll, scanning it in the quick manner with which a man reads over a document he had already committed to memory. An odd little smile came to his face.
Out of illusion, truth, he murmured.
He rolled the scroll back up and handed it to his empress. Shakuntala stared at the harmless object as if it were a cobra.
What is it? She demanded.
Dadaji's smile faded.
It's a letter from the King of Tamrapani, offering us an alliance, a partial alliance, I should say, against Malwa.
He shrugged.
The offer is couched in caveats and riddled with qualifications, but at the very least he makes a firm promise of naval and logistical support, possibly some troops.
He paused, taking a deep breath. Shakuntala eyed him suspiciously.
And what else?
The offer, this is not said in so many words, but the meaning is obvious, is conditional upon your marriage to one of his sons.
A wry smile.
His youngest son, needless to say. The King of Tamrapani is willing to risk something to keep the Malwa at bay, but only so much. Not the heir.
He stopped, studying the young woman who was Andhra's empress. Shakuntala was sitting very erect, her back as stiff as a board. Her face, if possible, was even stiffer. Holker tapped the scroll with a finger.
The king makes allusion to the false way in which we bandied his name about in Muziris. But he doesn't complain, not formally. It's quite clear that your seizure of Supara has changed the situation drastically. You're no longer an empress in exile. You have re-established yourself on Andhra soil, with a port here, and one of Maharashtra's largest cities, Deagiri, under the control of your forces. That gives you something far beyond formal legitimacy, which you already had. It gives you power.
He chuckled dryly.
Not much, but some. Enough, at least, that the ruler of Tamrapani is willing to use you to keep Malwa as distant from his island as possible.
He paused. Shakuntala's face was still expressionless. Dadaji suppressed a sigh.
Empress, we must consider this offer very seriously. A dynastic marriage with one of South India's most powerful kingdoms would greatly strengthen your position. It might well make the difference between Andhra's survival and its downfall.
Still expressionless.
Now Holker did sigh.
Girl, he said softly, I know that this matter pains you, but you have a duty and an obligation to your people.
The Peshwa rose and strode to an open window overlooking the harbor. From below, the sounds of celebration wafted into the palace. The governor's palace once. The Malwa official languished in prison now. Shakuntala had taken the building for her own. Watching the festive scene below, Holker smiled. Tripura was still celebrating 2 weeks after its liberation from the Malwa heel. Dadaji knew his countrymen well. The Marathas would have celebrated even if the city were in ruins. As it was, they could also celebrate an almost bloodless victory. Once the cannons which Kungas had seized opened fire, the Malwa warships had been turned into wrecks within an hour. By the time Shakuntala and her cavalrymen disembarked on the docks, the Malwa garrison had fled the city.
Celebrate, celebrate, celebrate.
Malwa is gone. Andhra has returned. The Empress herself is here. Shakuntala, Shakuntala, Shakuntala. Holker pointed down to the city.
If you fall, girl, those people will fall with you. You brought them to their feet. You cannot betray that trust.
Behind him, Shakuntala's face finally broke. Just a bit. Just a flash of pain, a slight lowering of the head, a slow, shuddering breath. But it was all very quick. Within seconds, she had raised her head.
You are correct, Dadaji. Draft a letter to the king of Tamrapurni telling him that I accept.
A new voice cut in.
I think this is quite premature.
Startled, Holker turned from the window.
Premature? Why, Kungas?
The Kushan was seated on his own cushion to Shakuntala's right. He had said nothing thus far in this meeting of Shakuntala's closest advisers.
Because, he rasped, I don't think we should jump at the first offer.
He spread his hand.
There will be others. The Cholas, for a certainty, now that Shakuntala has shown she is a force to be reckoned with, and I think their offer will have fewer caveats and qualifications.
He flipped his hand dismissively, almost contemptuously.
Tamrapurni is an island. The Cholas share the mainland with the Malwa beast. They have less room to quibble. Their offer will be more substantial.
Holker restrained his temper.
If they offer, I do not share your boundless optimism, Kungas. True, the Malwa pressed them close, but that is just as likely, more likely in my opinion, to make them hesitate before offering the Malwa any provocation. Kerala also shares the mainland with Malwa, and we all know how that fact led Shakuntala's own grandfather to betray...
I agree with Kungas, interrupted Shakuntala forcefully. We should wait. Not accept this first offer. We should wait. Longer.
Holker blew out his cheeks. He knew that tone in Shakuntala's voice, knew it to perfection. No point in further argument, not now. So he desisted, even did so graciously, although he couldn't help casting an angry glare at Kungas. No point in that, either, of course. As well glare at an iron mask.
What are you playing at?
Holker demanded after he and Kungas left the Empress's chamber.
You know how critical this question is. You and I have spoken on the matter before many times.
Kungas stopped abruptly. Dadaji did likewise. The two men stood in the corridor for a moment, staring at each other. The Peshwa angry, the Bharasvapati amused, perhaps.
Not quite, Dadaji, came the mild response. You have spoken to me on this matter, that is true, many times. But all I ever said was that I agreed that Shakuntala's marriage, whenever and however it comes, will be a decisive moment for our struggle.
Holker frowned.
Yes, and so?
Kungas twitched his shoulders. It might have been called a shrug.
So, that doesn't mean I agree that she should marry the youngest son of the king of Tamrapurni. I think she can do better.
Holker, scowling.
With whom? Chola? If, of course, the Cholas even...
Who is to say? Who is to say? Interrupted Kungus.
Again that little vestige of a shrug. The Parasvapati took his friend by the arm.
You should have more confidence in the Empress, Dadaji. When the time comes, she will know what to do. I'm sure of it.
Silence followed as the two men resumed their progress down the corridor. On the part of Kungus, it was an inscrutable sort of silence. On the part of Holker, an irritable one. Had the Peshwa known the thoughts of the Bodhisvapati at that moment, he would have been considerably more than irritated.
Dig in your heels, girl. Dig in your heels. Stall. Make excuses. Dither. I will help. I will help. When the question of marriage is finally posed, you will know what to do. Then you will know.
The Bodhisvapati shook his head slightly, thinking of the strange blindness in the people around him.
So obvious.
The general and his officer. Within a minute of his arrival in Agathius's room, Belisarius knew that the crippled officer was preoccupied with something. The cataphract was plucking at the sheets of his bed, as if distracted. The motion seemed to make his wife nervous. Or perhaps it was just that the young girl was fussing over her injured husband, the way she kept fluffing his pillows and stroking his hair. Belisarius decided that he should come to the point. He began pulling a scroll from his tunic. At that moment, however, Agathius turned to his wife and said, "Would you leave us for a moment, Sudaba? I have something I must discuss privately with the general." Sudaba nodded. Then, after a last fluff of the pillows and a quick smile at Belisarius, scurried from the room. Belisarius was struck by the way Agathius watched her as she went. Odd, really. He seemed like a man trying to burn an image into his memory. Once the Persian girl was gone, Agathius took a deep breath and looked to the general.
"I need your advice," he said abruptly.
"I will have to divorce Sudaba now, and I want to make sure, if it can be done, that the divorce does not cause problems for you. With your alliance with the Persians, I mean." He spoke the sentences quickly but clearly, in the way a determined man announces a decision which he doesn't like but must carry out. Belisarius's jaw dropped. It was the last thing he'd been expecting to hear.
"Divorce Sudaba?"
His eyes wandered about for an instant, as if searching for rhyme or reason hidden away in a corner of the room.
"But why?"
Agathius's face grew pinched. With a sudden, quick flip of his muscular wrist, the cataphract twitched aside the blankets covering his body. From the hips and above, that body was still as broad-shouldered and thick-chested as ever. A bit wasted, perhaps, from his long weeks of bedridden recovery, but not much. His legs, however, even that part of his legs which still remained, were pitiful remnants of the powerful limbs which had once gripped the warhorse in the fury of a battlefield.
"Look at me," he said.
Not with anger so much as resignation. Belisarius frowned, scratched his chin.
"It doesn't seem to me that Sudaba cares, Agathius. Judging from what I can see, I think she's not put off."
"Not that," growled Agathius.
The man's usual good humor made a brief re-entry. "Far as that goes, I think she's happier than ever," he chuckled. "I'm here all the time now where she can get her hands on me. And there's nothing wrong with my..." He broke off, sighing. "The problem's not with her, General. Or with me, for that matter. It's... He waved a hand weakly. "It's the way things are, that's all. She's a Persian nobleman. I'm a fucking baker's son with a battlefield rank in the military nobility."
Agathias glanced around the luxurious chamber for a moment, as if assessing its value. "I've still got plenty of booty left from Anatha. A damn little fortune by my own standards. But it's really not going to last more than a year or two. Not the way I have to live if I'm to meet her expectations, and even more the expectations of her family. I've got to face facts, General. I'm a legless cataphract, which is the most ridiculous thing in the world, whose only other skill is baking bread. There's no way I can..."
He gaped then, seeing his general burst into riotous laughter. Gaped. That was the last reaction he'd been expecting. With a fierce struggle, Belisarius forced his laughter down.
"Oh, God, I am sorry," he said weakly, wiping his eyes.
I feel so guilty now. I wanted the pleasure of telling him myself. I had to come to Perozshahpur anyway to refit the army, and so I thought I'd bring the news personally instead of just sending it by courier. Agathias's face was a study in confusion. News? What news? Belisarius was grinning now, and there was not a trace of crookedness in that expression, not a trace. He hauled out the scroll. As soon as it was clear that we'd driven the Malwa back to Carax, I sent, well, recommendations is hardly the word. Emperor or no, he's still my kid. I gave Phocius firm and clear instructions, and I'm pleased to say the marvelous boy followed them to perfection. He handed over the scroll. Here you are. The official document will arrive by courier some weeks from now. This is a copy sent over the semaphore line. Doesn't matter, it's as good as gold. Gingerly, Agathias took the scroll. In an instant, Belisarius's quick mind understood the expression on the man's face. You can't read, he stated. Agathias shook his head. No, sir, not really. I can sign my name well enough as long as I've got some time, but... He fell silent, not from embarrassment so much as frustration. The embarrassment in that moment was entirely Belisarius's. The general should have remembered that a man of Agathias's background was almost certain to be illiterate. The general waved his hand as if brushing aside insects. Well, that'll have to change, right off. I'll send word to Patriarch Anthony to send one of his best monks to be your tutor. Two of them, now that I think about it. Sudaba's probably not literate either, not a Dagon's daughter. Grinning. Can't have that. Not in the wife of a Roman senator recently enrolled in the ranks of the Empire's illustres. By unanimous acclaim, mind you. I also got a private message from Sidis. He tells me the Emperor's nomination was extremely... firm. Sidis himself took the occasion to appear before the Senate in full armor, in recognition, or so he told those fine aristocratic fellows, of the valor of the Greek Caniphracts at Anatha and the Nahar Malka. Grinning. The Emperor also saw fit to give the new senator a grant of royal land in keeping with his exalted status. An estate you've got now, Agathias, in Pontus. Quite a substantial one. Annual income's in the vicinity of 300 solidi. Tax exempt, of course. As an imperial grant, it's res privata. Grinning, grinning. Oh yes, there's real soldier business too, in addition to all the senatorial foufarah. You've been promoted. You're the new Dukes of Osrawini. That post carries an excellent salary, by the way. Another 400 solidi. In addition to the troops stationed in that province, you have complete authority over all Roman military units serving in Persian Mesopotamia, which are not directly under my command. You report only to me, in my capacity as Magister Militum per Orientum. Grinning, grinning, grinning. As you can see, I've picked up a few new titles of my own. As Dukes of Osrawini, your official headquarters will be located at the provincial capital of Edessa. But I'd really prefer it if you based yourself here in Perozshahpur. I've already discussed the matter with Beresmenus and Karush, and they have no objection whatsoever. Quite the contrary, actually. They're even hinting that Khusro will insist on presenting you with a palace. I think they would feel a lot more secure in Rome's allegiance if the commander of the Roman forces was planted right in their own territory, along with his Persian wife and... Grinning, 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 grinning. Soon enough, I've no doubt, a slew of children. The grin finally faded, replaced by something which was almost a frown. God in heaven, Agathias. Did you really think I'd let one of the finest officers I've ever had go back to baking bread? On account of his legs? Agathias was speechless. Belisarius rose, smiling crookedly. You're speechless, I see. Well, that's good enough for today, but make sure you've got your wits about you by tomorrow, Duke. I'll be coming by first thing in the morning. We've got a new campaign to plan against Malwa. You won't be riding any horses in that campaign. You'll be staying right here in Perozshahpur. But I'll be relying on you to organize the whole Roman effort to back me up. I won't fail you, whispered Agathias. No, agreed Belisarius. I don't imagine you will. He turned away. And now I'll go tell your wife she can come back in. Best thing for you, I think. He left then, murmuring a little verse. Think where man's glory most begins and ends.
and say my glory was, I had such friends.
A captor and his captives. 2 hours later, Belisarius was enjoying a cup of wine with Vasudeva in the barracks where the Kushan captives were quartered. A very small cup of wine.
The Persians are back to their stingy habits, groused Vasudeva.
The Kushan commander cast a sour look around the dingy room. He, along with 15 of his top officers, were crammed into a space that would have comfortably fit 6.
Crowded, crowded, he grumbled.
One man uses another for a pillow and yet another for a bed. Men wail in terror entering the latrines. Leaving, they blubber like babes.
Glumly.
Nothing to wager on except whether we will eat the rats or they us. Every Kushan is betting on the rats. 10-1 odds, no takers.
Philosophically.
Of course our misery will be brief. Plague will strike us down soon enough, though some are offering odds on scurvy.
Belisarius smiled. Get to the point, Vasudeva. The Kushan commander tugged his goatee.
It's difficult. Difficult, he muttered.
There are the proprieties to consider. People think we Kushans are an uncouth folk, but they are quite mistaken. Naturally, we have no truck with that silly Rajput business of finding a point of honor in the way you trim your beard or peel a fruit. Still, he sighed, we are slaves. War captives taken in fair battle, bound to respect our position so long as we're not belittled.
From lowered eyelids, he gave Belisarius a keen scrutiny.
You understand, perhaps?
The Roman general nodded.
Most certainly.
As you say, the proprieties must be observed. For instance, he drained his cup, then grimaced.
Nasty stuff. I've gotten spoiled on that good Roman campaign wine, I suppose.
He wiped his lips and continued. For instance, if I were to bring you along on my next campaign as a slave labor force, the situation would be impossible. War captives used for labor must be closely guarded, everyone knows that. All the Kushans in the room nodded solemnly.
Unthinkable to do otherwise, agreed Vasudeva. Foolish for the captor, insulting to the captive.
Yes, but since I will be undertaking a campaign of rapid maneuvers, feints, forced marches, countermarches, that sort of thing, it would be impossible to detail any troops to waste their time overseeing a lot of surly, disgruntled slaves. It would slow us down enormously in any event, since they'd have to march on foot. Can't have slaves riding horses. Ridiculous, they could escape.
Most improper, intoned Vasudeva. Grotesque.
Belisarius scratched his chin.
It's difficult. Difficult.
He raised his hand.
A moment, please, while I consider the problem.
He lowered his head as if in deep contemplation, sent a thought inward.
Aid? Piece of cake.
When Belisarius raised his head, a familiar expression had returned to his face. Seeing that crooked smile, the Kushans grinned. He gave Vasudeva, and then the other Kushan officers, a keen scrutiny of his own. You have heard, perhaps, that I have some small ability to see the future. Vasudeva snorted.
You're a witch, everyone knows that. Not even thumbsucking Persians will take our wagers on that subject. And we offered very excellent odds, 12-1.
Belisarius chuckled.
Slavery is an interesting condition, Vasudeva. It takes many forms. Different in the past than in the present, and different still in the future. Many forms.
He leaned forward. 16 Kushans did likewise.
Let me tell you about some slaves of the future. Lean forward, lean forward. They will be called Mamelukes.
A message and a promise. When Antonina opened the door, Kutina hurried into her bedroom.
I was hoping you'd still be awake, said the maid, even though you left the birthday celebration so early.
Her young face was eager, almost avid. She held out a sheet of papyrus.
It's a message for you. They say it came by the semaphore network all the way from Mesopotamia.
As she passed the paper over, Kutina added,
I think it's from your husband. I'm not sure. I can't read.
Uncertainly.
though it seems awfully short.
Antonina studied the message. Kutina was quite right, she saw. It was a very short message. Just long enough. Her heart soared. Next year, love. Next year. Yes, she whispered. I will be there. I promise.
An emperor and his people. The morning after his birthday party, Emperor Phocius made his way to the servant quarters of his palace. Trudge, trudge, trudge. Some of the 9-year-old boy's gloom came from simple weariness. The birthday party had been a tense, unhappy, and exhausting affair. What with a huge crowd and the presentation of the senators and the ever-critical eye and tongue of the Empress Regent, Phocius had enjoyed himself about as much as a sheep enjoys its shearing, or a lamb its slaughter. Mostly, though, his black and dispirited thoughts came from the news. Theodora had told him last night, just before the party began. Much as Phocius imagined a farmer tells his piglet, "How marvelous! Aren't you just the fattest little thing?" Reaching his destination, Phocius knocked on the door. That was the only door which the Emperor of Rome ever knocked upon. All others were opened on his command. The door to the modest apartment in the palace's servant quarters swung open. A young woman stood in the doorway. She was quite a pretty woman, despite the scars on her face.
"Oh, look, it's Phocius."
She smiled and stepped aside. "Come in, boy, come in." As he stepped through the door, Phocius felt his melancholy begin to lift. Entering the living quarters of Hypatia and her husband Julian always cheered him up. It was the only place in the world where Phocius still felt like himself. Hypatia had been his nanny since he was a toddler, and though Julian had only become his chief bodyguard recently, Phocius had known him for years. Julian had been one of Belisarius's Bucellarii. Julian himself now appeared, emerging into the small salon from the kitchen. He held a cup of wine in one hand, grinning cheerfully. The same cheerful grin the man had worn the first time Phocius met him at the estate in Daras. Phocius had been 6 years old, watching wide-eyed from his bed while a burly cataphract climbed through his window and padded over to the door leading to Hypatia's quarters, cheerfully urging the boy to keep quiet, which Phocius had that night and all the nights which followed.
"Welcome, Emperor," boomed Julian.
"Don't call me that," grumbled Phocius.
Julian's grin widened.
"Feeling grouchy, are we? What's the matter? Did your tutors criticize your rhetoric? Or did the Empress Regent find some fault with your posture?"
"Worse," moaned Phocius. "Terrible."
"Well, lad, why don't you come into the inner sanctum and tell us all about it?"
Julian placed a large hand on the boy's shoulder and guided him into the kitchen. Hypatia followed on their footsteps. The room, the largest in the apartment by a goodly measure, was crowded as usual. Two of Julian's fellow cataphracts were lounging about the huge wooden table in the middle of the kitchen, wine cups in hand, as usual. Their wives and mothers busied about preparing the midday meal, while a small horde of children scampered in and out of the room, shrieking in play, as usual.
"Hail Phocius, Rex Imperator!" cried one of the cataphracts, lifting his cup.
Marcus, that was. The other, Anthony by name, matched the gesture, and the words, though he slurred them badly. Julian plunked himself down at the table and said,
"Ignore them, lad. They're already drunk, as usual, on their day off." "So right," muttered Anthony. "A whole day without having a listener or fucking tutor nattering as the poor boy."
"Phocius has to listen to them nattering 7 days a week," said Hypatia. Primly, "Don't see him blind drunk 2 hours after sunrise."
"Course not," snorted Anthony. "He's only 8 years. No, by God, 9 years old he is. Birthday's yesterday."
He lurched to his feet.
"Hail, Phocius, Emperor of Rome!"
"Don't call me that," shrilled the boy. "I'm sick of it."
"Being called Emperor?" queried Marcus, bleary-eyed.
"No,"
groused Phocius.
"I'm sick of being Emperor."
He let out a half wail.
"I never asked them to."
And then a full wail.
"They made me do it."
The three cataphracts peered at the boy owlishly.
Disgruntled he is, opined Marcus. Downhearted and downcast, agreed Anthony.
Julian bestowed a sage look upon his comrades.
Phocius says he has terrible news to report.
It came out in a rush.
They're going to make me marry somebody, shrilled Phocius. Next year!
Very owlish peers.
Already? Queried Marcus. Seems a bit, early, concluded Anthony.
His eyes crossed with deep thought.
10 years old he'd be then. Still too early for his pecker to...
Don't be vulgar,
scolded his wife, turning from the stove. Anthony shrugged.
Speaking fact, that's all.
Hypatia sat down on the bench next to Phocius.
Who are you supposed to marry?
She asked.
Somebody named Tahmina, he replied sourly.
She's Persian, a princess of some kind.
I think she's the daughter of Barasmanus, the Persian ambassador who was here last spring.
The Seren? Hissed Julian.
His easy, sprawling posture vanished. He sat bolt upright. An instant later, Anthony and Marcus did the same. The three cataphracts exchanged stares with each other. Then, suddenly, erupted into a frenzy of table-thumping, wine-spilling exhilaration.
He did it! He did it!
Bellowed Julian, lunging to his feet.
Here's to the general!
Hallooed Anthony, raising his wine cup and downing it in one quaff. The fact that he had already spilled its contents didn't seem to faze him in the least. Marcus simply slumped, exhaling deeply. His wife came over and enfolded him in her plump arms, pressing his head against her breasts. All the women in the kitchen were standing around the table now. They didn't match the sheer exuberance of the cataphracts, but it was obvious that their own pleasure in the news was, if anything, greater.
Why is everybody so happy about it?
Whined Phocius.
I think it's terrible. I don't want to get married. I'm only 9 years old.
His plaintive wail brought silence to the room. Everyone was staring at Phocius. Gently, Hypatia turned the boy to face her.
Do you understand what this means? She asked. For me? For us?
Uncertainly, Phocius shook his head. Hypatia took Phocius's hands in her own.
What it means, Emperor, is... Don't call me that! Be quiet, Phocius. Listen to me.
She took a deep breath.
What it means, Emperor, is that your father has ended the long war with Persia. No Persian, not a Seren for sure, has ever married a Roman emperor. That peace will last our lifetimes, Phocius, and more, probably.
She turned her head, looking at Julian.
What it means, Emperor, is that my husband will not die somewhere on a Persian lance. Our children will not grow up fatherless.
She looked around the room.
What it means, Emperor, is that Anthony's mother over there will not have to bury her own son before she dies, and Marcus's wife and children will enjoy a comfortable retirement instead of grinding poverty on a cripple's dole.
When she turned back to face Phocius, her eyes were leaking tears.
Do you understand?
Staring up at her scarred face, Phocius remembered a night when that face had been covered with blood instead of tears. A horrible, terrifying night when a boy barely 4 years old had hidden in a closet while Hypatia's pimp savaged her with a knife for refusing a customer.
He'd been helpless, utterly helpless.
He'd only been able to cower, listening to her shrieks, powerless to stop the torment of the woman who had raised him while his mother was gone.
Powerless.
He lifted his little shoulders then, squared them. He was powerless no longer. He was the Emperor of Rome. True, the pimp Constans was beyond his reach. Years ago, when Marus and Anastasius and Valentinian had come to bring Phocius and Hypatia to the estate in Daras, they had paid a little visit on Constans. 2 years later, after he married Hypatia, Julian and several of his cataphract friends had tendered their own regards to the crippled ex-pimp. Constans was beyond his reach, or any man's now, but much else was not. Powerless no longer. He had never quite thought of it that way. had never quite realized what that meant. To other people. His people.
Okay, he said. I'll do it.
A new round of celebration erupted, in which, this time, Phocius participated cheerfully. He even drank 3 cups of wine with his cataphracts and got a bit drunk himself. And why should he not? He was the Emperor of Rome, after all. Their Emperor. A farewell and a parting thought. Beresminus and Agathius saw him off at the gates of Perros Shapur. As his army marched past, Belisarius and his 2 companions spoke briefly on the prospects for his coming campaign. Briefly, and more out of habit than anything else, it was a subject they had already discussed at great length. The time came when friends made their farewells, knowing it might be for the last time. Agathius was gruff and hearty, Beresminus was flowery and profusive. Belisarius was simply cheerful. Enough, he said. We'll meet again. Be sure of it. I don't intend to lose, you know. Quick final hand clasps, and the general trotted away to join his army. Damn right, spoke Aide. Then, Belisarius broke into laughter. What was that last, he asked. Sounded like those sorry bastards are fucked. Terrible language. But maybe not. Maybe you just said... Mutter, mutter, mutter.
The End. This book was read for you by Pete Bradbury, a member of SAG-AFTRA. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Destiny's Shield by David Drake and Eric Flint. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.